so much for coming up with this theme. It's only been productive for Beth and I to think about this. This is very much like a first draft of the paper of us trying to engage with homes for aquatic species. And we'll be swapping over halfway through. So, human capacity to sense and respond to the suffering of non-human animals is key to animal care and welfare. Elsewhere, we have researched and written about how these somatic sensibilities are drawn on by laboratory animal technologists in the course of their work. We noted how the ability of LATs, which is shorthand for laboratory animal technicians, to care for the species and individuals they work for is learnt through a combination of formal training, experience, exposure and participant observation, a particular learned disposition to care for animals and to deal with their emotional responses to them, the relationships developed with particular individual animals over time, and the broader cultures of care and social atmospheres within which they work. So intuitively, somatic sensibilities appear to afford responses best suited for human interactions with animals who are warm-blooded mammals, whose faces and bodies are at a scale where humans can attempt to read moods as we would those of another human. Indeed, those who have critically engaged with our work question on the utility of somatic sensibilities when caring for the multiple, demands a radical ability to remember outside of body-to-body care encounters, as Gail Davies has written. On a different point, what happens when within the care context, a body-to-body encounter is with a body so radically other to the human because of the environment they live in, or when the size and temporality of their creatureliness is out of joint with that of the human? Is there still scope for engagement over corporeal vulnerabilities? Franklin Jin is more optimistic about the scope of somatic sensibilities, still holding some merit in human slug encounters, where gardeners have been known to acknowledge shared but different corporeal vulnerability across species lines. However, in contrast, Astrid Schrader is more sceptical when the species is so radically other to the human, as in human-insect relations. Instead, she proposes a care sensibility called abyssal intimacy, which is her phrase, that caters for relations that are both intimate and wholly other. She argues that abyssal intimacy rethinks somatic sensibility as the possibility of sharing a fundamental vulnerability and as a radical passivity across infinite, discontinuous differences. This approach shares themes that resonate with the work of Jin, Beazle and Barua, who stress that for every meeting between creatures involves an irreducible strangeness and something singular, irreducible and vast behind each relation. For them, the encounter of being together with another can be about mutual incomprehension, alienness, withdrawal, detachment. Working from bodily encounters, somatic sensibility is a way to learn to respond, find an ethical impulse through the body sharing suffering or sharing vulnerability. Equally, following Schrader and Jin et al., would it be useful to add sharing incomprehension as the response in the bodily encounter? Haraway reminds us that the bounded entity with fully secured boundaries is the wrong unit for considering what is going on in these encounters. As she writes, this means not that a particular animal does not matter, but that mattering is always inside connections that demand an enable response, not bare calculations or ranking. Response, of course, grows with the capacity to respond. That is responsibility. Responsibility is a relationship crafted in interaction through which entities, subjects and objects come into being. People and animals in labs are both subjects and objects to each other in ongoing interaction. End of quote. So in this paper, we propose to engage with these critical discussions around somatic sensibilities in relationship to the multiple and the radically other through studying the responses of animal technicians charged with the task of caring for aquatic laboratory species. Toads, zebrafish and lobsters are some of the species that featured in our study. Well, despite the ethical invisibility of fish in the hostile space of water and the alien qualities of their bodies, Other scholars suggest that there are humans who have learned to love jellyfish and to reach out to cut corals with fingery eyes. Notably, in both these cases, it is the curious intimacies of the laboratory that have facilitated these entities, subjects and objects to come into being. So drawing on Judith Butler, Elizabeth Johnson suggests rather the care and love shown by Muraki, the technician, towards this jellyfish, is one born of a shared bodily vulnerability, born of the particular situation of the laboratory they worked in. The fragile bodies of the jellyfish and the fragile labour of a postdoctoral researcher. Somewhat counterintuitively, the environment of the lab and the precarities it generated became a force for generating capacities to respond between warm and cold-blooded species. And I quote, "Meraki's love is as much a part of the laboratory, the chrysals, the water filtration system, the moulding walls, the jars of brine shrimp and oil well research and development, as it is a part of their bodies and behaviours." Similarly, Hayward describes her own shifting sensibilities towards the corals developed through her time spent as a participant observer in the lab, notable in the development of what she terms fingery eyes. Her descriptions of how the experience of being with corals enhance their sensitivities towards the embodied and tactile dimensions of visual perception. Again, illustrating Haraway's argument, both corals and Hayward are changed by time spent in the lab together because of and in spite of the acknowledged power dynamics of the laboratory environment. As she writes, "We constitute a sensorial ensemble, becoming more than ourselves." Thus, we think there may be something in the laboratory environment that makes humans more attuned to the welfare of cold-blooded species. This may be in part because of the ways in which the laboratory environment is designed to make fish and other cold-blooded species visible to humans in ways which are unlikely to happen in other sites and spaces. Drawing on Jamie Lorimer's work on non-human charisma, we can note his observation that humans tend to be more attentive to species which occupies similar ecological niches that are land-dwelling, diurnal, visible to the human gaze, all of which rarely apply to cold-blooded aquatic species in the wild. Lorimer argues that, and I quote, "In general, organisms that are most dramatically other to us humans are unlikely to encounter us, given the alterity of their ecology. And when these encounters do occur, they are less likely to engender sympathetic affections." But the laboratory changes this. It brings in racks of bright blue technoplast, well-lit, clear plastic tanks. It brings these species up to our level, both making them visible and sensible to us, and Hayward would argue us to them, in novel and interesting ways. Could it be, as Hayward and Johnson seem to suggest, this co-becoming and cohabitation offers a route for the development of new modes of cross-species relating? Not only for observant social scientists and anthropologists, but also perhaps for animal technologists. So in this paper, we're going to draw on 2 years of research undertaken with laboratory animal technologists, notably not the researchers, but the animal caretakers. It was undertaken in UK universities between 2013 and 2015. We focus in particular on several interviews with animal technologists who work with cold-blooded species, including zebrafish, an increasingly popular model organism, trout, amphibians and lobsters. And in so doing, we wish to explore how caring and cold blood may both demand different kinds of skills and sensitivities and be shaped by different modes of relating.
So, we kind of wanted to start by almost arguing against ourselves. And our first point might be to argue that the development of shared sensitivities is very, very challenging within this situation. In fact, while observations of bodies and behaviours predominate in a lot of assessments of laboratory animal welfare, in cold-blooded aquatic species, they actually focus sometimes more on the environment than on the animals themselves. And water quality, for example, serves as a proxy for assessing welfare. And this is very much consistent with the approaches taken by animal veterinarians and other experts on fish welfare. So here we have Huntington talking about the key differences between fish and birds, meaning there are implications for their welfare that make you more inclined to focus not on things like food deprivation or markers on the body, but more on markers in the environment, because fish, he says, are in an intimate contact with their environment, through the huge surface area to their gills, so they're more vulnerable to poor water quality and waterborne latents. And this approach is something we found echoed in some of the ATs we talked to, who put a lot of time and care into developing their fish facilities, monitoring things like water quality, salinity, acidity. And indeed, what attracted some to working with fish was the technical challenges. So here we have an AT talking about the attractions of a water environment it's more difficult to work with. There are thousands of them in the tank. You have to look at biological status. You need to know the machinery. So there's kind of a technological appeal going on here and the challenge of keeping these species alive. This can have impacts on the development of the kind of sensitive relationships we were looking for. Here we have an animal technologist contrasting the kind of much more affectionate relationship she feels towards mice with those towards the trout she also cares for. You get to interact with the mice because you see them every day. I go in there and I have a conversation with them. But the zebrafish and the trout, it's just you can't do much. You just go in and clean their tanks, you feed them, you measure the temperature, do the test, that's it, that's all. Corals are even more radically altering in some ways. So for example, this AT here talks about how she sees the corals more as an environment that's inhabited by other species than species in and of themselves. It doesn't move anywhere. They're not animals, they're not really animals. They don't really evoke much kind of, they're mainly the habitat that provide a home for other different animals. In this way, we could say that water serves as a barrier to the development of cross-species sensitivities. Sensitivities we have, as Emma set out, argued are essential to performing care work. As 1AT again notes, as you put water in the way, it is a physical barrier to being able to interact with that animal because you have, they don't have an environment where they can just breathe air. You can't work with them without water. You can't just go and work with that animal and sort of get to grips with it. Okay, so far it's not looking so good. The unit of the singular bounded entity to care for the individual animal never seems to be there when you're encountering zebrafish or corals. Learning how to respond to zebrafish and corals so far seems to be interacting through technologies that affect the watery environments in which these species live. Laboratory coral balls are actually more seen as environments than individuals. Tiny zebrafish live in tanks in the hundreds. Animal technologists become machinery technologists. Vulnerability, suffering do appear to be harder to attend to. Secondly, there's the regulatory environment. And regulation for care and use of aquatic species, especially invertebrate species, is in the UK limited. And this is something, again, the animal technologists we talked to were very well aware of. For more junior staff, the ambiguity in welfare regulations resonated with their own lack of knowledge about the needs of the animals in their care. Not because they were unwilling to learn, but because the knowledge was just not out there. Even the Home Office, one tells us, don't know where to put those fish, like how to protect them. What's actually the animal welfare for fish, the extra enrichment? With mice, we have houses, nests, you know, you're building something for them. With fish, it's hard. They always swim. That's it. You know, we can't put a house. We put houses in the tank. So they're really grappling with both the regulation, their own sense of how to enrich the environment for these fish. In contrast with some of the more junior technologists, some of the more senior managers we spoke to began to criticise the lack of regulation. So one named animal care and welfare officer, so this is someone more senior for reviewing welfare within the lab, suggested that the welfare protocols for zebrafish were about 20 years behind those for mice, rodents and other warm-blooded species. Another noted the frustration with the lack of regulatory support for their work to improve aquatics and invertebrate welfare. For researchers, in contrast, regulatory spaces can be permissive, and most experimental work on zebrafish is carried out on eggs and fry under 5 days precisely because they're not covered by regulation. The jury is still out, it seems, on whether or not fish feel pain. So all the things we draw on in terms of sort of what our Campora calls symphysis to develop indicators of welfare or suffering in mammal species. So for example, in labs they use something called the mice grimace index to try and judge pain in mice, don't find easily equivalents in fish. However, one phytobiologist suggests that while fish do not have the neural mechanisms found to generate subjective experience of suffering in mammals, they're nonetheless complex animals with sophisticated behaviour. They probably have the capacity for suffering, although this may be different in degree and kind from the human experience of that state. And interestingly, for some of the researchers we spoke to, especially those who spent a long time working with a particular species, their experiences and observations began to correlate this, and they developed really strong convictions that cold-blooded species can and do feel pain. So here we have a quote from Carrie, one of the animal technologists we talked to, talking about her work with lobsters. And she talks about how handling lobsters, she noticed that they do react, in the second part of the quote, in ways that suggest they feel pain. So there's a challenge then in learning to be affected by cold-blooded species. There are limitations. For some, it's easier to work with fish than other species because there's that sense of distance and detachment. Here are two quotes from AT saying they found it much easier to work with fish than rodents. They're less like pets, one suggested. You can't hold them, you can't play with them. Fish are, they're not a pet, the second one suggests. Scale two seems to set fish at a difference. It's hard to identify with fish as individuals. And again, another quote sort of talks about how 80% of the fish, you can't tell one from another. Fish are easier to kill than warm-blooded species, partly because of the methods used. It's not like using carbon dioxide with a mouse. It's a very smooth process. And interestingly, this AT also compares it to going fishing. Fish death is something you've probably encountered and maybe even participated in before, in contrast maybe to mammal deaths. Yet at the same time, they're still developing skills and sensitivities. So the more we talk to them about how they assess fish welfare and how they engage with the fish, we get to understand some very careful observation and time spent with the species. You need to check very carefully, 180 tells us, you need to spend some time in the tank. You can actually notice, if you look very carefully, you can see. And what's emerging about this is a whole new set of knowledges about how to care and recognise and look for welfare in fish. So one of the technologists we spoke to begun to develop their equivalent of that mouse grimace index I mentioned for fish. And suddenly, rather than seeing 80 zebra fish in the tank, you saw different individuals with different welfare challenges, and she created these new charts of welfare indicators for zebra fish. And they respond to them by developing their own environmental enrichments. Again, one of the ATs we spoke to, concerned about the lack of progress in fish welfare, had actually spent considerable amounts of her own time, about 6 months, to produce these fake weeds from garden plastic bags, because you have to treat them to make sure they're non-toxic, to enrich zebrafish environments. So there's something more going on here, something that recognises these animals more as individuals. And I'm just going to bring the empirical section to an end with one of my favourite quotes, where one of the facility managers we were talking to is talking about lobster personalities. If you spend enough time with lobsters, they're incredibly charismatic, individual and appealing species, so I'm told. And here he's talking about their different characteristics.
So, some kind of preliminary conclusions. So, in this paper, we propose to engage with critical discussions around somatic sensibilities in relation to the multiple and the radically other, through studying the responses of animal technicians charged with the task of caring for aquatic laboratory species. So, our initial explorations of the data suggest evidence of sharing incomprehension and sharing vulnerabilities and suffering does take place. The nature of the cold-blooded aquatic species and their alien environment is emphasised by a focus on environmental proxies and technology. And this observation underscores the need to analyse, in Haraway's words, how, and I quote, individual animals, human and non-human, are themselves entangled assemblages of relatings knotted at many scales and times with other assemblages, organic and not individuated critters matter. They are mortal and fleshly knottings, not typological units of being. Individuals and kinds at whatever scale of time and space are not autopoietic holes. They are sticky, dynamic openings and closures in finite, mortal, world-making, ontological play. It's obviously challenging somehow to do this analysis in that form, but if we can, maybe we get away from some of the questions around the problems with the multiple and the questions about dealing with the environment rather than the individual animal. And with these assemblages of humans and aquatic species, the past experiences, what one might refer to as emotional pedagogy from fishing, for example, can inform both affection for and ambivalence towards fish welfare. And additionally, time spent in the task of caring for aquatic species through the proximity to them and visibility of them generated through the laboratory environment, seem key to the development of more nuanced and care-orientated dispositions, as noted by Hayward and Johnston, which in turn leads to greater convictions that, firstly, cold-blooded species can and do feel pain, and secondly, environmental enrichment matters for cold-blooded species. Thank you.